From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Hundreds of people in Maryland, most of them immigrants, are at risk of being forced or tricked into work for little or no pay. Sheena Wadhawan of CASA de Maryland tells us who is most vulnerable for labor trafficking. Then it's Mary Shelley's birthday tomorrow. Her most famous work, Frankenstein, is online in its original manuscript form, part of a digital archive co-directed by Neil Freistad at the University of Maryland. We talk with him about it. Plus, Tom Hall speaks with author James McBride about his novel, The Good Lord Bird, which depicts the abolitionist John Brown.
And I just wanted to create a version of him and a version of his life that was accessible to people, and that was also very funny.
And a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. Now news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WIPR.org. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. On Monday, we'll be celebrating Labor Day, a good time to revisit our conversations from the spring about the serious problem of labor trafficking. Labor trafficking is the use of intimidation, threats, and sometimes violence to force people to work against their will. The national nonprofit Polaris Project and others working to prevent trafficking say certain populations are especially vulnerable, such as immigrants. They may be working legally in the U.S., but their legal status is tied to a particular employer. Sheena Wadhawan, legal program manager for CASA de Maryland, knows these workers. She spoke with us about them in April. I began by asking her to define labor trafficking.
So, you know, when people talk about human trafficking, they often think about sex slaves, right? Trafficking and prostitution. But in fact, the more common type of trafficking is labor trafficking. And what we were talking about when we talk about trafficking are workers forced to work under coercion, some sort of threat, and usually quite underpaid.
And so sex trafficking and labor trafficking are both forms of human trafficking.
That's correct.
How big a problem is labor trafficking in Maryland?
Labor trafficking is very widespread all throughout this country and around the world. We see a lot of cases of trafficking in Maryland, in particular because Maryland is so close to Washington, D.C. We have a lot of diplomats and other folks who have special access to bringing in workers from other countries, special visas. And so we see a lot of widespread abuse against those domestic workers in particular.
Walk me through that.
So here's what happens. A diplomat comes from another country, and they will usually have had some relationship with the worker before. For example, the worker worked for them in their home country. And they'll say, you know, you do great work for me. Come with me to the U.S. We'll treat you very well. Here's a written contract that says you'll work 40 hours a week for X dollars an hour, which is always minimum wage or over, and we'll treat you well. We'll give you health insurance, et cetera, et cetera. And these contracts are required. The State Department wants to see those contracts before they'll provide that worker with a visa. So the worker agrees, gets here, and then almost immediately the employer will completely change the terms, right? So the contract won't be honored. Their passports, documents will often be taken away and held by the employer, and the employer will force the worker to work much more than what was agreed upon. And if they get paid at all, they will be paid much less than the minimum wage and the agreed upon wage rate. And then those abuses can get worse. So from there, you can end up with workers who aren't allowed to leave the house, who are locked up, who are abused in other ways.
Does it follow from that most trafficked workers are immigrants, not U.S. citizens?
In the cases that we see, and we are an immigrants' rights organization, mm-hmm. they are mostly immigrants. And I think we've got to be really conscious of the fact that in this country, there are many sectors in which most of the workers are immigrants. In home care, domestic workers are a great example of a workforce which is largely immigrant women. So when we talk about these sorts of widespread abuses, you're talking about really disproportionately impacting low-wage immigrants, and in particularly in the context of domestic workers, women.
You talked about so many of these cases being the workers being hidden in the shadows. How do victims come forward? How is it usually on their own that they come forward, or how are they found?
No. So for a worker to come forward, there usually is some sort of catalyzing event. So something very terrible that happened. So for example, in many of my cases, it's because the worker's been physically assaulted to the point where they fear for their lives. And it's at that point that they will run and get out. We have organizers, domestic worker organizers, who go out into the community and try to meet workers where they are. So, for example, midday at parks and things like that, where kids may be, where the workers may be with the children that they're taking care of. So it does take a lot of on-the-ground and active outreach, or a catalyzing event, or, someone's actually found really hurt somewhere, right? And then the police are called, and then they will reach out to organizations like ours to make a rescue.
When a complaint of trafficking comes to you, what do you do?
Well, the first thing we do is we figure out how to get the person out of the situation if they're not already there. So we have we create a nice strategy for getting the person out, and that usually involves, we have this beautiful active committee of domestic workers, and they are former abused workers who are survivors and have really become empowered, outspoken advocates for other workers. And so this big group of wonderful women will go out there and be support and help encourage that worker to leave that situation, and then our legal team will be back up, our organizers are on the ground, and if it's a very dangerous situation, we may use some sort of law enforcement standby. So we get the worker out, and then we talk to them, we figure out what's going on, what happened, and then we can attack it on many levels, right? So one is getting their unpaid wages. Usually these are folks who are owed thousands of dollars in unpaid wages, so that's a civil part of the case. The other part of the case is potential criminal action, right? Potential criminal reporting and criminal prosecution for trafficking. And the third is dealing with their immigration status. So one of the biggest problems in this context is that people's visas, their status in this country are attached to that employer. So the employer is really able to hold that over their head. And as soon as the employer fires them, those workers go out of status. And so that's the other piece that we will usually work on, and we'll explore a special kind of visa for victims of trafficking or victims of certain qualifying crimes.
Well, many of us see workers every day who aren't originally from this country. Are there any signs we should look for whether that person is being trafficked?
Absolutely. Every single one of us, when we are walking down our street, walking in our neighborhood, can take that step of just saying hello, smiling, giving someone a chance to maybe reach out to you for help. We see this in all sorts of industries. It may be someone working in the liquor store. It may be someone butchering your meat. And it may be a woman, walking down the street with a stroller. It is something that each and every one of us can do. One of many of the workers who come to us are so thin from not being fed in the homes where they are. So that's one sign. Or you may see workers crying. You may see workers that just look very harried. And in all of those situations, sometimes it's just a single act of kindness that can open the door and give that person the feeling of comfort and safety in order to come forward and say, help me, I need help.
I really appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sheena Wadhawan is the legal program manager for CASA de Maryland. If you see signs of trafficking, you can call the Polaris Project hotline at 888-373-7888. We'll have that number again at the end of this segment. This is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. In March this year, the United Nations criticized the United States' human rights record on several grounds, including not doing enough to prevent labor trafficking. The UN Human Rights Committee said it's concerned, quote, about the insufficient identification and investigation of cases of trafficking for labor purposes, close quote, in the U.S. The UN Human Rights Committee went on to note that U.S. labor law explicitly excludes some types of jobs, such as farm workers and domestic workers, from its protections, quote, thus rendering these categories of workers more vulnerable to trafficking, close quote. After we read that criticism from the UN in April, we reached Nathaniel Norton, a supervising attorney for Maryland Legal Aid, who does outreach to farm workers, and asked what he's seen.
What we see pretty regularly is what looks like trafficking to us, where people are so economically dependent on their employers that they're willing to accept really severely substandard conditions, accept not being paid properly, not being given all the work they're promised, not being given access to the outside world, access to health care, because they're afraid of losing their jobs.
Give me an example of a case that you saw.
Well, I guess what's fairly typical is people on the Eastern Shore simply not getting paid what they're promised, and if they complain about it, they're fired immediately. If they're lucky, the employer will just immediately put them on a bus back to Florida. Sometimes the employer will just abandon them here in Maryland or Delaware and not pay them, leave them with no money, and essentially homeless on the Eastern Shore. That happens several times every summer.
So what can be done to prevent the kind of situations you're describing, where workers are taking advantage of and don't feel that they have any recourse?
Well, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, they have much less recourse than a regular worker in the United States. Farm workers are routinely exempted from protections under federal and state laws that generally protect workers. They're exempt from overtime protections fully under federal law and only get overtime after 60 hours in Maryland. Under state law, they're often exempt from minimum wage. They're exempt from the protections of the National Labor Relations Act, so they can be fired for attempting to improve their working conditions. And so that creates a situation where there's not a whole lot of enforcement, there's not a lot of investigation, and there's where the law does protect farm workers, there's still not a lot of investigation by state and federal officials. They don't do much outreach to camps. I'm not sure the state does any. The state doesn't do any pre-occupancy inspections of migrant labor camps at all in Maryland, except for guest workers, but none for domestic workers. So there's just a culture of treating farm workers discriminatorily under the law, and it kind of creates a plantation mentality among employers and the workers themselves, I think.
I appreciate your telling us about this situation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nathaniel Norton. He's a supervising attorney from Maryland Legal Aid, and he does outreach to farm workers in Maryland. If you see signs of trafficking, you can call the Polaris Project hotline at 888-373-7888. Again, that's 888-373-7888. We've got the number on our website, too, and more information there, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, author James McBride on bringing the good Lord Bird to life. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Tomorrow is the birthday of 19th century English writer Mary Shelley. She's most famous for her creation of Victor Frankenstein, a character who has come to represent the prototypical mad scientist.
It's alive! In the name of God! Now I know what it feels like to be God!
As of last fall, Mary Shelley's novel, Frankenstein, is alive and online in its original manuscript form. It's part of the Shelley-Godwin Digital Archive. We spoke last October with one of the collaborators on the archive, University of Maryland English professor Neil Freistadt. He's director of the Maryland Institute for Technology in the Humanities at the University of Maryland. He joined us on the line from New York City, where he kicked off the opening of the digital archive. I began by asking him to describe it for us.
It gathers together from around the world all the known manuscripts of the works of Percy Shelley, his wife Mary Shelley, and Mary Shelley's two famous parents, William Godwin and Mary Wollstonecraft. Some people call them England's first family of writers.
And why is it important to focus on them?
They were crucial writers at a moment of cultural transformation. And if we look, for instance, at Frankenstein, there's perhaps no popular work that gets as much attention worldwide and gets reproduced in as many forms, because that work is so rich and was able to speak both to Mary Shelley's moment in compelling ways and to people through the next 200 years.
I think people enjoy Frankenstein so much and are so pleasurably frightened by it that the idea that it's great literature has kind of fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, and you know, there are several more famous literary works that live as high literature, poems by Percy Shelley, poems by Byron, poems by Keats. But somehow Frankenstein has managed to speak to so many that it's become a part of popular culture in ways that Shelley's Prometheus Unbound, for instance, hasn't.
Who are your collaborators in this digital archive?
My co-principal investigator on this project is Elizabeth Denlinger of the New York Public Library. She's curator of the Pforzheimer collection of Shelley and his circle. And Liz and I have been working with teams in the UK, in the United States, the Bodleian Library at Oxford, the British Library, Harvard's Library, the Huntington Library. And we've all pooled together their manuscript holdings. And we now have prepared for the archive 90% of the known manuscripts of those four important writers.
Now, I gather that because of the way the Shelleys and their parents wrote, that this is kind of more confusing than a lot of manuscripts might be.
Yeah, when you're looking at rough drafts, it's not the same thing as looking at a fair copy of a finished work that you can follow from start to finish. One of the reasons we started with Frankenstein as our first release from the archive is because it models the very close literary collaboration between Percy and Mary Shelley. And you can see it on the page, and you can see the archive is set up so that if you just want to see what parts of Frankenstein Percy Shelley himself wrote in draft, you can see those parts in his hand, or if you just want to see what Mary Shelley wrote, you can see those parts in her hand. And you get to see the very close collaboration that emerged from this novel, so close that there's been debates over the last 60 years since people have actually started studying the manuscripts themselves over how much of Frankenstein Percy Shelley wrote. And there are even some people who believe that he is the principal author of Frankenstein, although the evidence that everyone will now be able to access through our archive will show that that's simply wrong.
On 88.1 WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with University of Maryland English professor Neil Freistad. He's co-director of the Shelley Godwin Digital Archive. Victor Frankenstein says in Shelley's book, quote, "How dangerous is the acquirement of knowledge, and how much happier that man is who believes his native town to be the world than he who aspires to be greater than his nature will allow," unquote. One of the themes in the book is about the danger of knowledge, of technology. Is it ironic that you're putting this particular book's manuscript online?
Yeah, I mean, that's a wonderful question. And, of course, Victor doesn't follow his own advice, which is one of the main points. I think, though, when you take a step back, Mary Shelley's talking about a certain inflected use of technology, a kind of patriarchal, mad, heroic use of technology to make us all more than human in some way. And we think of the archive as one way for people to actually explore their own humanity. Technology can bring us greater insights into ourselves, just as it can give us possibilities for destroying ourselves.
So I gather that there's a lot more to this than simply being able to trace exactly who wrote what when. That
right.
There's a whole public annotation aspect to this. Can you give us an idea what that is going to be?
Yes. We are building an infrastructure that we call Skylark, and it's about building a participatory platform for enabling students in the classroom and people in the public to help curate the contents of the archive.
What does that mean?
Yeah. So in this case, curate means there'll be ways for people to see and correct transcriptions of the page images. And for many page images, there won't be transcriptions to begin with. That's not the case with Frankenstein, but that will be the case. And we will be inviting people to transcribe what they see. We'll be providing them with ways to encode what they see. And we'll be providing them with ways to annotate what they see. We don't right now have many citizen humanists, and one great goal of the archive is to provide a model for how citizen humanists, people who are interested in the content and research of the humanities, how they can play a role and be a part of it and enrich our cultural heritage.
Neil Freistadt is director of the Maryland Institute for Technology in the Humanities at the University of Maryland. We spoke last fall. The Shelley Godwin Archive will release Percy Shelley's Prometheus Unbound notebooks in the early fall. We've got a link to the digital archive at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Gass. More ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now, a conversation with National Book Award winner James McBride, who is one of the most distinctive and compelling voices in contemporary literature. His acclaimed memoir, The Color of Water, was a New York Times bestseller for more than 2 years. His first novel, Miracle at St. Anna, was made into a movie by Spike Lee. Mr. McBride wrote the screenplay for it, and he co-wrote the screenplay for Spike Lee's Red Hook Summer. His second novel, Song Yet Sung, is a gripping and elegantly told story of enslaved and free blacks on Maryland's eastern shore in the 1850s. His most recent novel begins at about the same time, this time on the plains of Kansas, where the legendary abolitionist John Brown is waging war on slavery. The book concludes with Brown's famous raid at Harper's Ferry a few years later. James McBride is also an accomplished musician whose compositions have been performed by many leading jazz artists as well as the PBS icon Barney. We're listening to McBride and his band play a tune called If Not Now, When? From an album entitled The Process. I had the great pleasure of speaking with James McBride at the City Lit Festival when he appeared there in April. The day before that appearance, he joined me on Maryland Morning to talk about his latest book, The Good Lord Bird. The protagonist, the person who tells the story, is a man named Henry Shackelford, who is looking back on events that happened when he was 12 years old and enslaved in Kansas in 1856. Introduce us to Henry Shackelford and tell us what his nickname was back at that time of his life.
Well, Henry Shackelford's nickname was Onion. And he meets John Brown, and when he's 10 years old, when John Brown comes into a tavern in which Henry's working with his father. And the thing goes bad, and John Brown pulls out his heater, and everybody pulls out their guns, and they start, you know, the whole thing goes awry, and John Brown grabs him and pulls him out and, quote-unquote, frees him or rescues him, thinking that Henry is Henrietta. He believes Henry's a girl. And so this kid, you know, he's dressed like a slave with, you know, his just potato sack and his hair is unruly and wild. And so he just basically plays along with it because he thinks that John Brown is crazy. So he goes through the entire book pretending to be a girl, told in the voice of a young black child.
Yeah. And John Brown is at the center of the book. What appealed to you about him?
Oh, he was crazy, you know? I mean, I was listening to John Coltrane's Free Jazz the other day, and I said to myself, people must have thought that Coltrane was crazy during his time. And I think they felt the same way about John Brown. I mean, you know, black people were not considered human during slavery. They were three-fifths of a man. And John Brown felt that that was wrong, and he felt that blacks were, the African-Americans were equal to whites and that they should be free. The Bible said it, and he believed it, and he actually did something about it, and which made him really quite unique because he did something about it in a most spectacular way.
So much has been written about John Brown. Was there something in particular that you wanted to make sure that people knew about him when you wrote this book?
No, I just wanted people to... I wanted to kind of commercialize him and bring him into the mythology of American life. You know, when we talk about the Wild West, we always we never talk about slavery, even though slavery was at the bottom of most of it. You know, Jesse James was a slaveholder, and he and his gang were child killers as well. But they're treated as these kind of mythical heroes. And I wanted John Brown thrust into that sort of, into that milieu, into that company. There are tons of books that are written about him, but history books are hard for people to read, and I just wanted to create a version of him and a version of his life that was accessible to people, and that was also very funny. Books about American history, and particularly about slavery, are very rarely funny. And if they are funny, they're funny at the expense of someone, usually the slaves themselves. I just wanted to write a book that made fun of everybody, and that was a book of caricature that people would read to the end.
Oh, well, people have no trouble reading to the end of this one because it is a hugely funny book. It's really funny and just insightful in so many ways. One of the best parts of it, or one of the best, most interesting dimensions, is the title. What kind of bird is a good Lord bird?
A good Lord bird is a huge woodpecker that's said to be extinct now, that was common really more in Missouri than in Kansas. And it's just a symbol that I use to thread throughout the book, because a good Lord bird feather is supposed to bring you good luck. And it was also a sign of this, if someone had that, because John Brown had a good Lord bird feather in his pocket. And I use that as a symbol throughout the book to kind of let the reader know, as they're kind of lighthouses, gateposts that let us know where we are and whether this is a good guy, this is a bad guy, and so forth.
James McBride's latest novel is called The Good Lord Bird. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So, James, you write a lot about the Underground Railroad in your previous novels, Song Yet Sung, and Harriet Tubman plays a significant role in that story, obviously. She also makes an appearance in this book. What was her relationship with John Brown?
Well, in real life, she had a very good relationship with John Brown. And Harriet Tubman is probably the only character in this book that I did not make fun of, because she was so serious and so smart. And of all the American characters in historical fiction and in history that I've come across, I can't think of anyone who was more, that I respect and admire more than Harriet Tubman. She was brilliant. I suppose it makes Maryland interesting for me, and that's why I spent so much time there on both my third and fourth books. But it also made her, during John Brown's time, a linchpin character in terms of his attack on Harper's Ferry, because she promised him that she would be there. But the problem is that John Brown moved on Harper's Ferry a week earlier than he was supposed to. He was forced to do it. And like most things in John Brown's life, they never really quite worked out the way he had drawn them up. So she didn't come to Harper's Ferry. She didn't make it, because by the time she was ready to move there, he had already been caught and captured and imprisoned.
Yeah, and so many other things went wrong. I mean, he had hoped to raise a good number of enslaved people to help with the fight, and couldn't get to them, couldn't reach them, and couldn't get the plans spread. I mean, it was a calamity sort of almost from the beginning, and his whole tenure in this book, his whole and he moves around. You go to a lot of places in this book. We're in Kansas, we're in Missouri, he goes to Philadelphia and to Boston, ends up in Harper's Ferry. He was really plagued by all sorts of things going wrong, but he was so purposeful and focused about what he wanted to accomplish. He was sort of indefatigable.
Well, listen, when you create a wave, you don't know it's happening. You know, you push it along, and then you go away, and then it just leaves you. And he never really saw this wave that became, you know, a gigantic tsunami, because he had already passed away by the time he died. But the force of his will inspired 19 men to 18 men to their deaths, and probably a lot more than that. One of the problems in researching a book like that, like John Brown and also Harriet Tubman, is that you don't really know what happened, because the people who wrote the history, a lot of them were white, and they just wanted to keep it quiet. There were lots of insurrections and lots of revolts, but the news of them never got far, for the obvious reason that, you know, white slave owners didn't want people to know that, didn't want other blacks to know that insurrections were happening. It was kind of like the Gone with the Wind syndrome, you know. It was just
Sure.
Everything's okie-dokie.
I mean, the characters that you develop, they're all so vivid. They're so incredibly real. And we meet each one at the beginning of the book, and we really, by the end of the book, you feel like you know them really well. But you have a degree in journalism. You've worked as a journalist. You've been a reporter. How did you research this book? How did you sort of divine what the true personalities were, given that so many times the histories were written by people with all sorts of conflicting agendas, and white people writing about black people whom they didn't know, and certainly did not have the personal experience? Who'd you trust when you were researching this?
God, man. I mean, it's not hard. You know, God gives you a brain. I mean, it's not hard really to surmise how African Americans and whites got along during slavery when you look at how we get along now. There's so much, you know, undisturbed territory in terms of how we talk and deal with each other that it really wasn't that difficult. All you have to do is just lay the template over it, meaning the template being that there was a boundary that people could not cross physically and in some ways mentally, but people traversed it in really, really clever ways, even during slavery time. So I just read a lot of books. I visited all the places that are talked about, most of the places that are talked about in the books. And then I just let my imagination loose, because I know that people, basically I believe that people, all people, white, black, Latino, Asian, whatever, they all basically want the same thing, and people basically try to move toward the right. When I say not the right politically, I mean toward the right thing. And with those things, you know, with those beliefs in my heart, the characters come to life and you kind of start to see them for real.
These last two books have both been set in the middle of the 19th century. Is that particular period really important to you because slavery was in its prime, as it were, in its heyday? Is that the reason you're delving there?
I'm not sure, you know. And it's sort of like, I remember I was doing a session with this drummer, and I said to him, can you play the same thing you played before? And he said, I can't. He said, it's just in the air, you know. And so when I start to research these books, I don't really think about that. I just, you know, who are the compelling characters that make the thing go? And then I try to figure out who the ancillary people are to kind of get the plate spinning. I think one of the reasons why slavery was and is so attractive to me is because of the moral ambiguity that it represented for so many people, because so many people were against it, but so few people spoke out. And we have these same problems now, but it was much more distinct during slavery because it was a white and black issue. It so happens that during 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act had really made slavery a problem for the northern states, because slave owners were coming up and grabbing blacks off the street, and northerners were getting, you know, pissed off about it. And it had kind of come to its... The pot was boiling by 1850. And by 1859, it was overflowing with steam and whatever else boils out the pot once it's going. So that was a good period where people started to really kind of rise up against it. And John Brown was at the epicenter of that.
James McBride's latest novel is called The Good Lord Bird. He spoke in April, the day before our conversation, at the Pratt Library, which was the culminating event in this year's City Lit Festival. We've got a link to a podcast of that conversation on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Join us on Monday for a special Labor Day edition of Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Caleb Stein will be here to talk about his latest CD, and Sheila will talk to the daughter of the great photographer, Aubrey Bodine. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR in Baltimore. Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay produce the program. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. The good folks at Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville bring us our morning Java, and on the web at zekescoffee.com. We're online at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. We hope you'll stop by the website and leave a comment about something you've heard, or make a suggestion about an interview you think you should hear on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great Labor Day weekend.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.